Call this meeting of the Amador County Board of Supervisors to order on this Tuesday, December 6, 2022. The board has met in closed session. Item 1, conference with labor negotiators, report from staff. Item 2, conference with county council, existing litigation, County of Amador versus Kathleen Allison, CDCR, Mule Creek State Prison, report from staff. Item, it could be 3A. Was denied. The claim was denied by the board. Claim of Renee Samuel, estate of Michael Wood. And with that, confidential minutes were approved. The board will go back into closed session after a regular meeting. Could you all stand and join me in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Move on to public matters not on the agenda. Discussion items only. No action to be taken. Any person may address the board at this time upon any subject within the jurisdiction of the Amador County Board of Supervisors. However, any matter that requires action may be referred to staff and our committee for report and recommendation for possible action at a subsequent board meeting. There is a 3-minute time limit. And Mr. Kirkpatrick, I see you're first up. If you could sign in, sir.
There's no pen.
Here you go. Can I throw you one? Thank you, sir. Morning.
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 I wanted you to know the EPA last year came to me and says, we want to clean up your property. If we don't clean it up for you, you're going to have to clean it up. It's going to be contamination from the Argonaut mine. They promised me it'd be done by September. It's December now. And it's they're not done, and I don't know what I can do. I've been beating my head against the wall trying to argue with EPA, and they just keep dragging things out. And I think the creek, and they've tore up part of Mariposa Street. I already approached Public Works to look at that. And there is some sediment going down the creek all the way to Stony Creek Road. And I don't know if there anything that anybody can do with them.
Mr. Gillette, you got any advice on this one?
I'm not sure the county has any leverage on that in this situation. The board supervisors can reach out and try to, you know, get them to stick to timelines or address any issues, or we can have staff do it. I don't know any of these particular issues with the road or the stream, but
yeah, I just wanted to let you know and inform that there's nothing I can do with them. I mean, they ignore me. I mean, even the one guy, oh, real nice, talk to me, call me anytime. Well, I haven't been able to get a hold of him for 2 months. He's in Indiana somewhere, the main guy doing for Intac. They got the EPA, Corps of Engineers. They got an engineer overlooking somebody. It's EO. Then they have a company called Intac doing the work. And those guys are from throughout the United States. There's guys from Michigan, Texas. More than one guy from California working on their project. But
have they... They haven't given you any timelines then? They just, no communication?
They're not going to get it done this year.
Yeah.
We're in a swamp now. They took the dozer out yesterday, a couple days ago, and it went down about 2 foot. It's a mess out there. I guess they've been trying to go in there. And then they tried to bring in straw. Well, my cows attacked the straw and destroyed the bale. So now they put up a fence across there. I got them to put up the fence. But it's just an ongoing thing that I've been dealing with them for over 6 months.
They brought straw in. I doubt if they're going to get it done anytime soon. At least
they're not going to get it done till next summer.
Right.
They said it would be all done, smoothed out, seeded, hydroseeded, and irrigated, and it'd be just fine. Well, it's a mud mess now.
Well, possibly on behalf of you as a constituent and property owner, the county can send a letter to try to find the right person, correct person to send it to, and ask for a response. Would that work for the board?
Yeah, I just want the board to know that nothing I've been able to do with them, and that you're probably going to maybe get some complaints from downstream for the, although I own a lot of the property downstream from that, where the contaminated stuff's going. It's not contaminated now. It's clay. I think it came from District 2 now.
No comment.
Well, I'll say this, John. If you were doing that, they'd be all over you.
Yeah, they'd be all over me. But they're doing it, and they're the EPA, okay?
Yeah.
They're supposed to be protecting the environment. Well, they're messing it up pretty bad.
Protecting you, John.
Huh?
Well, they're protecting you.
Yeah.
We'll try to find the right person to at least.
Yeah. I already talked to Public Works about the road. They're going to look at that today. So.
Okay.
You ought to see the driveway, the encroachment I got going into my property there. It's completely destroyed. And then there's some checks on Mariposa Street. Might be worse now. They just moved their big excavator out of there this morning.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
See you, John.
McDonald, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. I'm speaking on behalf of New California State. People are really upset about what's going on in the government right now and what's going on. Everybody's complaining, but they say, we just don't know what to do about it. They're just so depressed, and they don't know what to do about it. And when I say, well, New California is the answer, oh, well, that'll never happen. Okay, so let me tell you, yesterday Paul Preston gave this second notice to the governor of California yesterday at the Capitol. And this is the second declaration of constitutional default. The citizens of New California have decided to remedy the abuse of power by the government of California by exercising their right to form a new state provided by in the United States Constitution, Article 4, Section 3 and 4. So please look that up and find out what we are doing and how we're doing this. Our treasurer, Chris Street, about 8 years ago, he was the treasurer that was involved in the Orange County bankruptcy, if any of you remember that. He is a world-known accountant, and he even lectures in China, and he's looked at California, and he looked at the finances, and he said that in 2021, California will be bankrupt. And it would have happened except that COVID money, a big input of billions from the federal, came in and held us over so that we managed to get through 2021. All right, now we're 2022. Yesterday, the governor called a special session of the legislature to figure out how to get some money to raise taxes on gasoline, or they're going to close the schools. They have to figure out a way to raise some money because they are billions of dollars short each month for meeting their budget this year. Last year was great because we had all this, the stock market was really high, and a lot of people sold to get to pick profit, and they had to pay taxes on that. I understand that Elon Musk had to pay a couple million dollars in taxes because he had to had stock options that he had to take care of. Well, that's not true this year, and it has been very, very bad money-wise. Chris is going to talk to you about the actual financial situation of the state of California. The answer is New California State. Go to the website, newcaliforniastate.com, and you can find out what our plan is, what we're going to do. Our plan is to have lots of dams and water, cheap electricity, and bring businesses that have left our state to come back to California. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think clarification too, Lois, I think maybe Chris Street came in the Orange County bankruptcy after it happened. He was not responsible for the actions, I believe.
He had prophesied it. He tried to get people to do things to stop it, but it happened, and he was the account. He was not in charge. Actually, one of the mayors went to jail.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning, Board.
Morning.
Morning. Is there open comment, too, for the item 6A with Rita Kerr? Is that for public? Can we speak during that, or is that?
During that.
During that? Okay.
Yeah, then would be better.
Okay, but I'd like to speak on this first.
If you have time to stay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, make time.
Okay.
Okay, so the financial default, that's what Lois is talking about.
Can you, Chris?
Yes.
Last name?
Strong.
Okay, thank you.
For my own. And it's a shame because we've got so many resources in this state, and it's not going to the people. It's going to these international corporations and whatnot and agencies. But California fails to provide, as required by law, an audited financial statement. And California is the only state in the union for which the last 3 years that has not provided an audited financial statement. And lack of proper financial oversight by the bumptious California legislature, that by allowing agency employment of persons who were knowingly and willfully engaging in high-risk assumptions to underfund pensions in the normal course of their employment, have now put at risk the financial default of the state teachers' retirement system and the California public employees' retirement system. Reported by the California Globe about the Employment Development Department, EDD, on November 28, 2022, just weeks ago, California EDD continues to borrow hundreds of millions, about $13 million per day, to meet its obligations. From seeing itself primarily not as a claimant benefit agency, but tax collection outfit, to have a customer service policy of not having a customer service policy, to technology older than the word technology, the EDD has had problems for years, and now a Federal Department of Labor review of the agency's unemployment insurance benefit trust fund, the account employers pay into, raises further questions about the stability and capability of the system as the fund's solvency level is zero. According to the latest State Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund solvency report, the state still owes the feds more than $18 billion against a trust fund on-hand balance of about $600 million. The report also shows California has an advance from the feds per covered employee amount of more than $1,400. The national average is $353, and most states have a figure of zero. The state of New California believes the EDD is a major source of funds to foreign countries through a money laundering scheme that involves the California Department of Motor Vehicles, in which there was an estimated $850 billion laundered through the EDD since the beginning of the pandemic. However, since 1996, under the Motor Voter Act, the number appears to be upward of $30 trillion laundered from the California state EDD. California is in a state of free fall at all levels. This free fall has been orchestrated over the last 170 years by socialists and communists, and now nearing the end of their socialist-communist plan that clearly demonstrates a design to reduce United States citizens living in California under absolute despotism. Today, this plan has eliminated the three branches of government and created a monoparty legislature that has enabled and empowered the rise of a pusillanimous governor-turned-dictator, an unconstitutional administrative state now exists in California in direct violation of the September 9, 1850 compact with the United States of America. The state of California no longer functions as a Republican form of government. And like Lois said, we're basically, I mean, most people, many people agree it's we're fragmenting apart. And financially, our borders, sanctuary status, the California state is, I mean, it's being ripped away from us. And so we seek a peaceful alternative, like Lois said, release the energy, the hydroelectric energy, the all the mining resources, the water resources, and we have a solution, and we seek to do it in a peaceful way, and we hope to get your look into it more and more and take it seriously, because we really seek to solve this issue. Thank you.
All right,
I'll pass this out to you guys.
All right, thank you. Any other public comment from anyone in the board chambers? There anyone on Zoom, Heather?
Not at this time.
All right, Supervisor Brown.
Yes, thank you. Last Friday, Supervisor Neto, myself, and our deputy county counsel went to a meeting in Sacramento dealing with PG&E. It was a 2.5 hour gripe session, I will say that, from multiple counties dealing with PG&E on our, what we've kind of nicknamed it, the whack and stack of what PG&E does for lumber, anything over 4 inches that they won't take from people's properties. One of the biggest hurdles PG&E is throwing back at the counties was permits cost and personnel costs of dealing with the vegetation. The CPUC is trying to put $40 million into biomass projects, so there's some output of what's going on. The one thing that PG&E is supposed to be working on is a regional model to coordinate tree problems that are going on in the counties, because each county had its own war story. It was incredible how many, how many 10 counties were representatives, Supervisor Nodal?
Probably, I'd say, yeah. Maybe a few more if you bring in Zoom.
Yeah, that's true. Everybody from Humboldt down to Mariposa. But we all had the same horror stories, of customers being left with huge logs on their property and not being able to dispose of them. So we're supposed to be going into a probably monthly or quarterly meeting with PG&E, seeing how they've changed, how they're supposed to be coming around and doing some tours of the different counties. And so I want to appreciate RCRC for coordinating this, and I also want to thank the board for putting it on the agenda last September, putting it on the board, on the agenda. Was one of the steps that was the tilting of everything to get it to go, so we could get some good communication with PG&E. Because right now we're just dealing with the lowest levels. Well, we were dealing with the vice presidents and a lot of them.
Yeah, no, I think it's been elevated because you've got like the Rural County Association, the RCRC, and you've got CSAC, it's California State Association of Counties. They're getting involved, and so there's enough people, enough counties complaining. I think it's got some attention, and basically, like what Jeff and I were saying, pardon me, at that meeting is, yes, PG&E is going out, and they're reducing their liability exposure to their lines by cutting down trees. But what our problem is, and other counties, their problem is the same as ours, is it's basically expanding the county's exposure to fire problems and the citizens' exposure to fire problems, plus also it's a mess. So, I mean, a lot of the public, hey, they're not equipped to cut up trees, 4 foot in diameter, 150 feet long. So, but it seems like we're getting some traction. Part of the issue seemed to be that PG&E is funded to do some of the tree removal and some of it they're not. And that seems to be the real real issue, and they're saying, hey, that, you know, CPUC won't kind of doesn't fund, won't allow them to do all of it and be compensated for it.
Right, but we the one thing that was really important during this meeting is the CPUC was in attendance. So they were seeing it direct hand to what we were complaining about, what we were dealing with. So that was I think it's a door that came open.
Okay, thank you. And you're right that the answer is not just to cut them and wait for them to decompose. I mean, they're creating a significant fire risk. So thank you both for going down to that meeting and staff also. Any other public comment from the board? Anyone else? No? Okay, we're going to move on to our approval of the agenda. We have one addendum, administrative agency discussion of possible action relative to the definition of what an agricultural operation is as it relates to barking dogs.
So move.
We'll put that on 6D on our agenda and move by Supervisor Brown. Second by Supervisor Crew. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Approval of the consent agenda.
Move to approve.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Crew, second by Supervisor Ornetto to approve the consent agenda. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. We'll go to our regular agenda, 6A. Update by our Amador County Health Officer, Dr. Rita Kerr, on the COVID-19 situation in Amador County, and I assume she'll be talking a little bit about what's going on across the state and the nation right now in some areas.
Good morning. Are you able to hear me?
We can hear you. If you could wait just a moment, Dr. Kerr, we'll get your face up on the screen.
Thank you. Yes, the video control is not working from my end.
Okay. Why don't you just continue with your report then, and good morning.
Good morning.
Excuse me, Dr. Kerr, go on and start your video again.
Okay. There it is.
There you are.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Forrester, supervisors, and Amador community. I'm here today to bring you the December update. The COVID-19 situation in Amador County, in addition to other respiratory illnesses. Winter viruses are circulating in Amador County, including COVID, influenza, and RSV, which is respiratory syncytial virus. Multiple schools in Amador County have had over 10% of students absent daily throughout the month of November, and elevated school absenteeism has continued because of illnesses that have persisted since the Thanksgiving holiday break. Pediatric hospital and healthcare capacity have been strained, and public health is working with local and regional partners to manage the respiratory illness surge. As I speak to the hospital impact, the board clerk can start to bring up the first first graphic, thank you. For hospital impact, there are currently 5 COVID-positive patients hospitalized at Sutter Amador, 2 of whom are in the intensive care unit. And to date, 418 Amador County residents are known to have been hospitalized because of COVID-19, which is an increase of 7 since last month. Over the weekend, a local child was transferred to a hospital in the valley for pediatric care because of respiratory illness with septic shock. And as of yesterday morning, there were 2 more children holding in the emergency room at Sutter Amador awaiting transfer to children's hospitals in the valley. The epi curve here is specific to COVID and shows the laboratory confirmed cases in blue and the probable cases in green throughout the course of the pandemic on a week-to-week basis. And you can see that to the far right, in the lower right corner, is the current situation. The higher week that is from last month was due to a COVID outbreak, including one in a senior care facility, and there was another workplace outbreak that was reported to public health as well. You can see the last few weeks is an upward trend, and that is reflected in our active case counts as well. Currently, there are 42 known active cases, which are confirmed, probable, and suspect cases reported to public health in the past 10 days. for Amador County residents, and that is up from 26 active cases a week ago. The case counts do not include self-tests that are done at home, which are not consistently reported to public health. And Mule Creek State Prison currently has 3 active inmate COVID cases. If we could switch to the flu activity map.
Dr. Kerr, mm-hmm. could you go back that for 1 second?
Sure.
You're trying
to look at the epi curve, the blue and green bars?
Yeah, it looks like it's vanished. That was, what, a 2.5 year period? That chart, you really can't see the...
Yes, it's since March of 2020.
So about 2.5 years, what that shows?
Yes. The trajectory over time of what cases have done. Now, what's changed over that time is the availability of antigen testing, which is where the probable cases come in if they're a supervised antigen test. So fewer people are getting the lab test sent out for laboratory confirmation, which is really the only testing we had available early on. And also what's missing from this picture is the home tests that are very, very commonplace now. So this raw case count is not as reliable an indicator of activity as it used to be. We really are starting to look more closely at hospitalization rates and test positivity rates for what's happening activity-wise for COVID. And then a couple of these other graphs I'll show you look at other winter respiratory illnesses as well. So we can go ahead and move on to that map of the U.S. And I don't know whether we're going to just look at the map or whether we're going to look at the one that...
We have the map up now.
Okay, great. Thank you. So this is a snapshot of the week 47. A new influenza season starts every October 1st. Week 47 of the year is about 8 weeks into the influenza season. And there is a map available on the CDC Flu View website that you can push a play button and see how the colors have changed from week to week. And I don't know if we'll have a chance to view that here and now, but everybody started October for the most part in the lower half of this color scheme and the minimal, low, or at the most moderate activity. But we have seen this progression to high and even very high levels over most of the country, including California, in this most recent week, which actually ended right at Thanksgiving week. So we expect this to be, you know, even more intense in color because we've seen hospitalizations, for example, double in number across the country since Thanksgiving. There's another graph, the next graph, if you could show that, that is a little bit more California specific. I'll wait till that comes up before I describe.
Dr. Kerr, is that the influenza admission percentage rate or the RSV?
Influenza, please.
Thank you.
So, thank you. This map, the far left, the blue line that's a little bit more bold with the dots, is showing us that we are seeing much earlier levels, earlier in the season levels that are elevated compared to the 5 prior years. And you can see we had a pretty nasty season in 2017, 2018. That was before COVID, of course. That really peaked right around the holidays, Christmas to New Year's. Hospitals were very highly impacted with influenza admissions. Fortunately, that peak fell down pretty rapidly within the first month of the new year in 2018. But, you know, what we're dealing with this year is not only this elevated activity for influenza, but at the same time, we are seeing COVID admissions go up and RSV admissions go up. And we can switch to the RSV graph, please. And thank you. So this one is showing RSV admissions higher, again, earlier peak than usual. It started at the latter half of last season. It's a little bit hard to see, but the faint yellow line that's kind of at the top, just above week 38 to 39 there, is where we started to see the increase back in late September. That increase continued on this upward trend throughout the months of October and November and is just starting to level off from the standpoint of RSV admissions. Fortunately, we are seeing that decline. The hospitals have plateaued, although they're still at an elevated rate. And most of this admission activity is young children, children under five, and really infants are the most vulnerable to severe illness from RSV and hospitalization. And then the last graph I'll show is also from Northern California, Kaiser, which serves as a sentinel facility with regular reporting, but it's pretty reflective of what's happening in Northern California. And this next one is showing that the laboratory test positivity for RSV, when that one comes up, also, oh, there we are. Nope, that's the influenza. Go forward, forward one more. And there should be one more following that. There we go. This is the good news for RSV anyway. While we are seeing ongoing increases in influenza and COVID, the RSV has peaked and fallen, and we are seeing that this has happened. We say that 2 points make a line and not a trend, but now we have 3 points in a row decreasing for RSV laboratory detections in that bold blue with the dots on it. That's our season to date. This mirrors what we saw in the southeastern portion of the country, which was a few weeks ahead of where California is from this standpoint. One other kind of important thing to note here while I'm thinking of it is that we do not have a vaccine currently for RSV. There are several in development, but really all we can do to prevent this one is all those other common hygiene practices like washing hands frequently, staying home when you're sick, wearing a mask to prevent transmission of respiratory viruses, and really trying to protect those young infants who are the most vulnerable by not taking them into social situations during this high respiratory illness season of the year. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move on in my report back to COVID-focused topics at this point. Since last month, two additional confirmed COVID-19 deaths have occurred in Amador residents. One was a man in his 80s, the other a woman in her 90s. That brings the total confirmed COVID deaths to date to 87 Amador County residents, as well as 9 Mule Creek State Prison inmates. There have also been 3 Amador residents who died of COVID that meet the criteria to be officially tabulated as a probable COVID-19 death. Public health continues to extend our sympathies to all who have lost a loved one because of COVID-19. It's especially hard as we celebrate the holidays this time of year. Moving on to the preventive measures and
Dr. Kerr,
to manage COVID. Yes.
Yeah, this is Supervisor Anetto. So you had, I think it was one gentleman in his 80s that died and one lady in her 90s. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Was that?
Yes, over the past month, those have been tabulated newly.
Mm-hmm. Was that death with COVID or was it death because of COVID?
These are because of COVID. We do not tabulate and calculate the those individuals who may have incidentally tested positive for COVID. This means COVID was either the direct cause or a significant contributing cause of death on the death certificate and substantiated by review of the medical records.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome. I'll go ahead and switch over to now what we're doing to continue to manage the ongoing COVID situation. Speak to vaccines first. The updated bivalent COVID booster vaccines are available for everyone ages 5 years and older. The updated boosters have been reformulated to better cover the currently circulating strains of the virus. The timing to get a bivalent booster is at least 2 months after completing a primary series or your most recent dose of the COVID vaccine. If you've been recently infected, it's a good idea to wait at least 3 months before getting the updated booster. You will have some immediate boost in your immunity after an infection, that so to extend your duration of immunity from the vaccine, it's best to wait a couple months, up to 3 months after that. The COVID vaccine primary series must be completed before getting the updated bivalent booster, and you may choose a different vaccine for boosters than you received for your primary series. When you come in for a booster dose appointment, please bring either your little cardboard card that was given to you, a photograph of it, or a digital vaccine verification so that we can see the dates and types of previous doses that you've received. The COVID vaccine clinics for everyone ages 5 and older continue to be held at Health and Human Services and at the back entrance, Suite 500, on Tuesday mornings between 8:30 and 11:30, and Thursday afternoons between 1 and 4 o'clock. We do have both primary series and booster doses of vaccine available, and public health currently has Pfizer, Moderna, and Novavax vaccines all in stock. You may visit myturn.ca.gov to schedule an appointment or call 1-833-422-4255. Those who have an appointment are prioritized, but if you have trouble scheduling or you don't have time to schedule, or you're out running errands and you're like, I should just go get that done, we will accept walk-ins to those Tuesday morning and Thursday afternoon clinics. Those with appointments are prioritized, and the walk-ins must arrive at least 30 minutes before the clinic ending time. It is not too late to get your seasonal flu vaccine. Get protected before holiday gatherings and travel. Public Health is offering flu shots given at the same visit during the Health and Human Services clinics on Tuesday morning and Thursday afternoon. Unfortunately, we did not get a supply of the high-dose flu vaccine, which is recommended for those 65 and older. But if you are over 65 and you can't find high dose, it's best to get whatever vaccine is available to you, and we'd be happy to take care of your needs at our clinic. You can check with your doctor at a pharmacy or visit vaccines.gov to see if you can locate that high-dose vaccine for influenza. Parents who are interested in having their younger children, ages 6 months through 4 years old, vaccinated, should talk with their doctor or may call Public Health at 209-223-6407 to schedule a vaccine appointment. And a parent or legal guardian must accompany the child to that appointment. COVID vaccines and boosters are still free of charge for everyone at this time. And boosters are important to maintain high levels of immunity as we're going into this high activity winter virus season. They protect against severe COVID-19 illness and death. The mobile vaccine team provides vaccination for homebound individuals who may make an appointment by calling Public Health at 209-223-6407. Moving on to COVID testing and treatments. At this point, Medicare and Medi-Cal both allow pickup of free test kits at pharmacies up to 8 per month, and private health insurance pays or reimburses for 8 at-home test kits per month. Antigen self-test kits are also available at Public Health and some local agency partners, and schools are distributing tests to students and staff. If you test positive, please follow all self-isolation guidelines, inform your close contacts, and quickly seek medical advice to find out if treatment is recommended for you. Talk to your doctor. Call the California COVID-19 hotline at 833-422-4255, or you can go to covid19.ca.gov/treatment to find free treatments, including potentially a free telehealth visit if you have tested positive and have symptoms, even if you've tested positive at home. Seek treatment while symptoms are still mild. Do not wait for the illness to get worse. The whole point is that the treatment is to prevent the illness from getting worse. And there is growing evidence that the treatment reduces risk of persistent long COVID symptoms. The OptumServe testing and treatment site At the back entrance of Health and Human Services, Suite 500 remains open on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. The OptumServe site will be closed on two Mondays, December 26th and January 2nd, to observe the holidays. Register for a supervised antigen test with OptumServe by visiting lhi.care online or by calling 888-634-1123. COVID, PCR, or molecular test swab collection that gets sent out to the lab is still available upon request at the OptumServe site. When you visit the site, bring a complete list of all medications and supplements you're taking with you to that visit to screen for potential drug-drug interactions if you need treatment. And testing and treatment at the OptumServe site remain free of charge at this time. Masks continue to be required in all healthcare settings, including at both vaccination clinics and the test-to-treat site. Viruses are part of the natural world. Winter virus season is not something we can control, but we can prepare for and plan around it. Be aware of symptoms, stay home when you're sick, and make sure that you're taking advantage of the powerful vaccines, tests, and medications that are available. With few community-wide safety measures now in place, more people may be vulnerable this winter. It's even possible to get infected with more than one virus at a time, which can increase severity. Wash your hands frequently. Wearing a mask indoor in public places is a good way to limit the spread of germs. Getting vaccinated for flu and boosted for COVID-19 is likely to help keep many of us out of the hospital. Protect yourself, your loved ones, and our community. If you don't feel great, please isolate and get tested to treat it and beat it. And I'd be happy to address any questions at this time.
Thanks, Dr. Kerr. Any other board members? Supervisor Ronetto has asked quite a few questions already. And Supervisor X, no?
No, not at this time.
Okay, back to Supervisor Ronetto.
Yeah, I still had another one. Mm-hmm. You know, are they still advising young men to get the COVID vaccines? Because I believe there's I believe there's been some articles that show that young men are at a particularly high risk of getting myocarditis and possibly pericarditis, especially myocarditis from the more so from the vaccine than even from COVID. Does that sound correct?
First of all, the COVID vaccine is recommended for everyone ages 6 months and older to protect against severe illness and possible death. The risk group that is at highest risk for myocarditis are young men from adolescence through young adulthood into, some would say, middle adulthood in their early 30s, perhaps. The risk of myocarditis from COVID leading to actual death is much lower than the risk of myocarditis after a viral infection. And actually, there was just a new study that was summarized in the Cleveland Clinic summary that I check daily in this week's summary that definitely the risk of myocarditis leading to death is higher after getting COVID than it is after the COVID vaccine.
But not the risk of getting myocarditis.
Both conditions can cause myocarditis, the virus itself, if you're infected with it, or following vaccination. The course of myocarditis after vaccination tends to be much more mild and manageable than the course of myocarditis that can follow a viral illness. So the risk is higher to get it from natural infection, the myocarditis because of natural infection, than it is if you get a bout of myocarditis after vaccination.
After, just talk about after second dose, that it becomes, the risk is great, much greater after second dose than it is not.
The risk is higher after the second dose, and that is what led to the recommendation to lengthen the interval instead of 3 or 4 weeks out to 8 weeks or longer for that second dose in young men.
Yeah. Also, you know, what's, I've talked to a couple OBGYN nurses, and they were talking about the number of ladies they're seeing that are having feminine issues. They seem to think coming from the vaccines. Have you heard anything like that?
If you could elaborate on what you mean by issues, are you talking about changes in their menstrual cycle length?
Menstrual cycle stopping for like up to a year.
I haven't heard menstrual cycle stopping up to the year, but yes, the menstrual cycle length has been reported and is being studied, but so far there's been no effect on fertility and no effect on fetal outcomes following the vaccine.
They're saying, like, especially ladies 16 to 30, they're seeing a number of them having that issue. And I thought, wow, that seemed of note to me.
Again, that has been reported. Part of the V-Safe monitoring inquires specifically, have you noticed a change in the length of your menstrual cycle? And there are a number of women who have checked yes in response to that question. They'll receive a follow-up call to be interviewed for more details, and it's just an area that's being studied. But as I said, although that's been seen, it hasn't so far led to any consequences with either fertility or fetal outcomes following the vaccination. And in fact, the miscarriage rate is higher among women who get infected with COVID during pregnancy.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Dr. Kerr.
Well, thank you.
It mm-hmm. looks like L.A. County, have they gone back to full mask mandate or still considering it at this point?
They do not have a mandate in place that I am aware of. They have gone to a strongly recommended status because of their elevated COVID-19 activity in Los Angeles County.
Okay. I've seen a lot of people that have been going to Disneyland over the last month, and Disneyland has to be much worse than L.A. County when you have that amount of people, the mass of humanity together. So is it just a knee-jerk reaction to the spike in COVID cases?
Are you talking about people wearing masks again?
In L.A. County, heading that direction,
well,
looks like.
So L.A., well, first of all, Disneyland's in Orange County. It's in Anaheim. Close to L.A. County, but not quite there. And there are certainly folks who have seen what's happening in their community, or they know they're walking into a situation that puts them at higher risk, and they want to take a precaution, so they're going to wear a mask. Also, I think another area that is, you know, just incredible amounts of mixing of people is in public transportation hubs. I mean, it's the time of year where we're getting on planes and trains and heading off to see our loved ones together for the holidays. And a lot of people are really conscious about, I'm going to be seeing grandma and grandpa, and I don't want to pick up something on the way and bring it to them. So people are hopefully taking those additional precautions during their holiday travel and getting boosted before they leave for their trip.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to go to public comment, Chris.
Yeah.
And if you could identify yourself for Dr. Kerr.
Dr. Kerr, my name is Chris Strong. I'm in the county here. And I have Epoch Times and the Children's Health Defense Fund have done an incredible job over the past year. Have you read some of their material about the COVID negative side effects?
I don't read those publications on a regular basis, no.
Well, I have a recent article where they took CDC data, and I didn't print this all out to bring you guys, but they have, let me bring it up here. They have the total COVID deaths since September of last year, and they show that there's a very clear, like you were talking about trends earlier, a completely clear trend of the deaths, of COVID deaths were in September 2021, it was 77% non-injected, non-vaccinated people, mm-hmm. and by the time they got, well, that's when the boosters started too. So by the time they got to January, of this year, the COVID deaths were actually higher in vaccinated people than non-vaccinated people. Have you looked into that?
I actually am aware of that statistic, and there are several contributing factors to that. Number one, COVID has always been mostly affecting the older population most severely. The risk of death for someone over the age of 60 is significantly higher than someone over the age of 30, for example. Our highest vaccinated population are the most vulnerable elderly individuals, many of whom live in congregate senior care homes. And so by definition, as the pandemic has persisted and different waves of new variants have come along, some of which have had immune escape, there are times that the virus can overwhelm even that immune system. And so over time, those two factors, both the fact that the most vulnerable population is also the most highly vaccinated population, and immunity wanes over time, and new variants can escape immunity. Yes, it's true that the statistic has flipped. At this point, the vaccinated, 58% was the last number that I saw, of COVID deaths during the latter part of the summer into early fall of this year were in folks who had been vaccinated. What was not available in that statistic was, were they current on the most recent booster at the time they got COVID and died from it? We see this over time with vaccination campaigns for just about every disease that we have. There are always individuals whose immune system is not as robust, and those are the ones that we really say, even if you're vaccinated, if you get sick with COVID, if you test positive, even if your symptoms are mild, seek treatment early, because you need to layer on all these things that we now have available to us in order to have the best possible outcome.
Well, then,
not everyone's going to need treatment. So, do you mind if I say one more statement and then I'll hear you out? Not everyone's going to need treatment, but I think it's definitely worth making that call and finding out if what you have for your other health conditions, be it high blood pressure or diabetes or asthma or anything else, qualifies you for treatment if you get exposed to and end up contracting and testing positive for COVID.
Well, if not everyone needs treatment, why were they being forced to take it to keep their jobs?
Okay, the difference between vaccines and treatment. A vaccine is something that enters your body either through an injection, or some of them are given via nasal spray. You might remember that they used to put polio vaccine on sugar cubes and put it under the tongue. It gets into your system, and it stimulates your immune response to recognize the offending virus that it needs to fight off. It basically gives your body kind of a call to arms. It creates an army of immune cells that are ready to be deployed if your body sees that virus again.
Right.
That's what a vaccine is. It is not considered a treatment. It's considered a prevention. Treatments now are something different.
Okay.
It's like taking an antibiotic if you have an ear infection that's caused by a bacteria or a bladder infection. Antivirals are medications usually taken by mouth, occasionally by injection, that are formulated to actually, once the virus is already in your system and you're testing positive, the antivirals interfere with the virus's ability to keep reproducing itself and causing higher viral loads and more severe illness.
Is that,
so taking the treatment early
interrupts
that reproduction.
Uh-huh. Is that why the zinc and the hydroxychloroquine work together to prevent that viral spread?
So zinc is a mineral that probably has some beneficial effect on the immune system.
Is that being recommended then? If it's probably
it certainly wouldn't hurt for someone this time of year to use a zinc supplement if they have been exposed or have a mild illness. It's been around for many, many years before COVID. It's one of those ingredients in some of the over-the-counter remedies that are advertised to help you fight colds and flu.
Well, it's certainly much cheaper. Sorry to keep jumping in, but, you know,
other people want to comment.
Yeah. Well,
I just give
a personal testimony that you might want to hear. So at my job, one of my bosses, he took I call it the clot shot, not to be demeaning or rude, but he, within 24 hours, he went into emergency, he went into the hospital with upper and lower respiratory problems. I have another friend I coach soccer with. He took the vaccine. Within immediately, he went into seizures, and now his red blood cell count has plummeted. He gets blood transfusions. I have another person in my small group Bible study. We were all against taking it. He took it, and about a month ago, he went into ER at 190 beats per minute, resting heart rate. So, and when I see the deaths, the majority of them being vaccinated people, I don't see how you can argue that they're safe and effective, because my whole life I've known natural immunity. Our bodies are created in incredible ways by God to fight this and have memories, and I mean, I've had, my whole family's had, and I've overcome it. So I don't see how we can keep recommending these shots and making them free. We don't talk about zinc. We don't talk about hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. We don't talk about having a healthy diet and going outside. I mean, go get sick so you can overcome it.
Chris,
we're living in fear.
Chris, I'm going to have to cut you off now because
I
just can't let you.
I've been waiting a whole year and a half.
I understand, but I can't let you monopolize the discussion here either.
I'm done, but I'm sure you have answers to all that. I just want that to be on the record. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Kerr, any response, or do you want to move on?
I will just say that both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin have been subjected to intense study and scrutiny, and neither of those, unfortunately, has panned out to be an effective treatment for COVID.
Okay. And Chris, I gave you a lot of time to say your piece, so okay. Just don't want you to feel like you were too prematurely cut off there. All right, thank you. Any other comments from the board? Any other public comments? Anyone on Zoom? All right, Dr. Kerr, thank you for being here again today.
You're welcome.
All right, goodbye.
Okay.
All right, we'll move on with our regular agenda item 6B, Meals on Wheels program, update by Mr. Chris Carlton, Executive Director, Amador Senior Center, regarding the program. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, board. Good morning, staff. Thank you for having me here to give just a brief update. I have a PowerPoint for you. It's only four slides, and then, of course, you're free to ask questions. But I thought it was a good idea to come, since you have heavily funded this program, to give you a little brief update since we took over the Area 12 contract starting July 1 of 2022, to let you know sort of what we've done with not only state funds, but with the funds the county's committed to this vital program in our community. So the Senior Center continues to provide these services for a small $4 contribution from clients in the community. And on that $4 request for each meal from our clients, we receive on average about $2.10 from that. So about half is what we receive to provide these services, which speaks to the relevancy of really needing the support of the county and state funds, the community funds also through Giving Tuesday, to make this program possible. To give you an example of the growth, the explosive growth of about 100%, a doubling of meals served in January, we served 1,525 meals, went out to people in Amador County to continue to support them living independently. And in November of 2022, we served 3,045 meals. So you can see we've used the funds the county has given to us to really expand out our services. And I think I've been pretty consistent reporting to you each expansion facet of our program, moving up country into Pine Grove and then eventually Pioneer. Here's a map that shows you where we are now as far as deliveries. This is currently today where we will be making deliveries. We have a small cohort in River Pines, as you can see, a little bit in Plymouth. I would direct your attention to the bottom left. You can see Comanche is now on our radar. And you can see that these are some pretty remote areas where older adults live and reside. And they are pretty isolated areas where people don't have a lot of social connection or contact. So this is the highlight of their day a lot of times is what we're told. Our drivers are told that I was waiting for you. This is the highlight of my day to interact with you and receive a hot meal. Again, to remind the board, this is every single day a hot meal delivered to.
Now you said Plymouth. Older. I don't know. Is that little marker actually supposed to be in Plymouth?
That is roughly Plymouth, isn't it? Up near 49 there, yeah. Just.
Okay.
Yep.
So it's just up. It's up a little bit higher than it should be then. Okay.
We provide services to Plymouth, but that's who's called to request those services.
Okay.
We've done marketing through the paper and radio, and so far that is who has requested services in those pockets. The totals here on the next slide will show you really where we are delivering. Ione and Comanche has about 47, Jackson 42. You can see the totals for yourself for a total of 170 clients now is where we are in the program. So that's all I have to report, just to give you that update on where we are and what we're doing with funds committed by the county. Do you have any questions for me?
I was just curious on the map, if you could back up one, Heather, near Ione, what Dagon or Dagon is. I've never heard of that.
That's a map I pulled up through Google Maps. You can see at the bottom. So
you've never heard of that?
Good question for Google.
It's on every Google map, along with Sunnyside.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what it's Sunnybrook, but I'm trying to figure out what Dagon is.
I think it was probably there 100 to 150 years ago, is my guess. So why it's there, who knows?
Yeah, if that was there, Mill Creek should be there too, and everything else. So, anyway, I'm glad you're doing the service to Comanche now. You know, it looks like is the each dot a person?
Each dot is a delivery address.
So there's not a lot going out in the Comanche area right now. It looks like three if you include Buena Vista.
There are two in Comanche North Shore for sure.
All right.
And I'm not sure about the Buena Vista area.
It looks like one near it, probably Lake Amador.
Yeah, they're stacked on top of each other. So if we deliver to neighbors, and we do oftentimes deliver to a couple of mobile home areas out there, and the homes are next to each other, those they're going to overlap.
That makes sense, because Plymouth shows is Plymouth River Pines show like two, but there's what, like 30 actually?
No, there probably are like three or four.
No, your other numbers show 30.
They show, if you go back to the the totals, the slides, the
shows
last
30.
Slide, there, the very last slide. There you go. So it's Pioneer, River Pines, Plymouth area is 30. All of those areas combined.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that included Pioneer. Okay.
Right. Yeah, they're all in a conglomerate there.
Okay.
But that's pretty solid growth, Chris. I remember 2 years ago, was it four or six in Pine Grove when the first meals went up?
A year ago in 2021.
A year and a half ago.
Early summer, yes.
That was.
Right.
Well, I think what you're having, too, is a couple things. I think some of the restaurants have closed down that were in different places, or they're having problems getting staffing. Some of the restaurants are not always open like they used to be. And go to the grocery store. Talk about sticker shock. I mean,
hamburger's $13, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, groceries have gone up substantially.
Well, the subject isn't the one that we're considering today, but our congregate programs have certainly seen a huge uptick from people, I think, for those very reasons that you're speaking of. Folks are using our program as a means to combat and fight inflation in their own lives.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Has the in-house lunch program suffered with this delivery, or are they operating on parallel tracks?
No, the congregate program continues to experience its own growth. As I just said,
okay.
The clients seem to be using and utilizing those resources to help combat inflation in their own personal finances. So we're seeing a larger uptick. For example, our Thanksgiving meal, which was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, of course, we're closed on Thanksgiving. Our congregate site here in Jackson saw 122 clients come in and have lunch.
Wow.
So we're seeing a huge influx of people coming through. I think what would be limiting some of that would be the fuel costs, which we're absorbing not only fuel costs in our delivery program daily, but the food costs as well. It's almost a double whammy. And then soon coming here in January, we're going to have labor costs go up quite a bit as well. So we continue to need the community's support financially to make this program feasible.
I asked you about Common Ground Senior Services, because what your duty is, what their duty is, I kind of know yours better, but are they still doing some of the delivered home meals? And I saw them both on Giving Tuesday as recipients.
Yeah, you're not alone in the confusion between services. So Amador Senior Center provides all home-delivered Meals on Wheels services in Amador County now. Common Ground Senior Services ceased operations for home-delivered Meals on Wheels services as of January 30th, 2022. As of January or July 1st, 2022, we took over all their clients. So we provide all home-delivered meal services as well as congregate dining. And we have a congregate site here in Jackson. We have one in Ione, and we have one in Pioneer that just started in August.
So Common Ground Senior Services, our Common Ground is working through Area 12 now to provide services. Is that correct?
So Common Ground is providing services, transportation services in Amador County. That's the only service they provide for older adults.
Okay.
In Calaveras County, they continue to provide Meals on Wheels for Calaveras County.
All right. That helps. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other board?
Supervisor Brown, the one thing I can say is that it is a joyous thing to go over on a commission on aging and then having lunch with everybody over there at the congregate setting. I have not had a bad meal over there. It's been very, very delicious food. You know, I've always thought of a cafeteria type of food. It wouldn't be good, but no, it's always wonderful to go over there and have a congregate meal. I do much appreciate it.
Thank you for participating at the center. We appreciate your presence there so that you can tell other people in your constituency what we do. And we work really hard to make these to be very high-quality, flavorful meals that seniors receive. And every meal that we serve at the congregate site is identical to what our clients at home receive as well.
I think Supervisor Brown likes to partake of those meals.
I do.
Okay, that's what I thought. You do a good job there. Any public comment? Anyone on Zoom? Board members, anything else?
Chris, just thanks again for all you do.
Yeah,
I really appreciate you coming in unprompted to give a report.
Yeah, thank you for your support in this project. I really appreciate it. It really does help us to overcome some of those real difficult factors of rising costs that we're hopefully going to see alleviated here in the next year, but I'm just not sure. So thank you for your support financially and your belief in our program and even your participation in our program. We appreciate that.
Not a problem.
Come by and have lunch sometime, anytime, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, we'll go on to item 6C, the minutes. I submitted one minor correction.
Motion approved with that one correction.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the minutes. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. And we have our one agenda item on barking dogs and interpretation of the agricultural operation. Mr. Eiley, do you want to lead this, and we'll send it over to Supervisor Axe after that?
Well, the item came forward when Supervisor Axe had a constituent that was complaining about a neighbor's dog that was barking. Animal control investigated, and the dog that was barking, the owner contended that it was guarding some chickens and that the entire thing was an ag operation under our ag ordinance. And
how many chickens?
12. Okay. And thus was protected by the ag ordinance. So that being the case, the question came up, We talked with Supervisor Axe about that, and the question was, should we define ag operation a little bit better so that anything doesn't generate immunity for a barking dog? Is a barking dog that's protecting a garden from deer, is that, you know, do we want to redefine that, or would we?
Yeah, from my understanding, the dog itself is a, you know, a shepherding type dog, so it's bred for that type of purpose. Supposedly, from my understanding, and I was hoping the one person would be here today, I informed them of it, that the dog does stay out there. It has impacted her because her she has a rental property and the tenants moved out because of the dog. I believe that the owner of the dog is trying to do things, so you know, that's good. But it just might be good looking at the ordinance. Does the board want to further clarify things or leave it? An agricultural operation looks pretty wide open, and staff, meaning animal control, you know, really has no direction here. They, you know, they just kind of say, okay, you know, it must be an ag operation. But I will accept, you know, whatever the board wants to do, whether you want to do anything or just leave it as is. But I ask you to consider interpreting it.
For clarification, what kind of dog is it? Do you know if it's a...
It's like a Pyrenees, I think.
A Great Pyrenees.
Yeah.
So it is a protection dog. Usually they're sheep, but not chickens.
Yeah, and apparently the constituent is getting their own protection dogs for their goats and other livestock, and those dogs will be out in the field with the sheep 24/7. They're not pets in her case. So if that's what the guy's doing, then okay. But I just want to know, is there any interest in doing anything here, or are you happy to leave it the way it is?
For clarification, you said the constituent who is complaining is getting a
her tenant moved out, and they believe it's because the dog is barking all the time.
You know, I'll say this. This is an ag county. I do recognize barking dogs can be a problem at times. And normally people seem to try to work with neighbors. Sometimes it can be pretty tough. I mean, especially those guard dogs, that's what they do. And it's funny you bring up chickens, because I had a Anatolian Shepherd Great Pyrenees, and it used to bark some at times. And it got old and passed away, and all my chickens soon disappeared. And we got a 6-foot cyclone fence that goes to the ground. It's pretty secure with a little wire along the top, and couldn't figure out. We thought it was probably a bobcat, maybe coon, maybe skunk, and so my son went and put up a game camera, and it was day before yesterday. There's a picture of it. It's either a coyote or a fox. And that's like maybe 60, 70 feet from my house. And we'd waited like 6 months or almost a year to get more chickens. We thought whatever it was would probably move on. Well, I think we had the chickens for like 3 days, and two of them disappeared. So now, and that was like we were locking the little sliding door so they couldn't get in. And one night we forgot to lock the door and lost more chickens. So I could see where, you know, and we're probably getting more pressure now upcountry from lions. I mean, and bears. I'm seeing the amount of bears up around Pioneer is just off the charts. When you see the pictures people put up next door, Facebook, it's just, it's a pretty big bears. And I think so. It can be a problem, the dog. I mean, I'm glad to hear that people are working on it, but I think if we go and start trying to tell people, you know, you can't have a dog for your ag operation, hey, I mean, a chicken is, if somebody has chickens, that's an ag operation. And people, a dog is, it's like how my son has a cat he dearly loves, and he told me a while back, oh, he kind of didn't want Spike going out at night. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's probably a coon or something. Won't bother your cat. But, well, we got a fox in her or a coyote in her backyard, and my son was right. So I can see where having a dog is probably a good thing when you're in a rural area, even semi-rural area. I don't really want to go into it because I think where would you start, where would you stop? It'd be pretty problematic, I think.
Well, and I asked, we do have a noise ordinance, but right. That's not... But
they were, animal control did not want to enforce it because they felt that this superseded the barking dog ordinance.
And so, we believe it does.
So that's the issue. The there is a ordinance that deals with a barking dog. So if a dog or any domestic animal is making a loud noise for 15 minutes or more consecutively, can be a nuisance under our code. But under the ag ordinance, basically says things that are ag related that are done consistent with an ag, you know, ag practice are not nuisances under our code. So you have this sort of conflict. The ag ordinance saying it's not a nuisance, it can't constitute a nuisance, and the barking dog ordinance saying this is a nuisance. So if it is an you know, so with this particular case, it there are some factual questions. Is this really an ag dog? Some people have Great Pyrenees as pets, but it does seem to fit the ag ordinance in a kennel outside next to the chickens.
Well, I had that experience, you know, without my dog, all my chickens were soon gone.
So what this board is saying, if you have a herding protectorate dog and it's embedded in the ag operation, then that counts as that qualifies for the exemption then. Is that correct?
I would say yeah.
Okay. So if they're just living in the house and close by but not really, you know, right next to the ag operation, then that does that qualify? Yes or no?
I would just say I think the ordinance does sort of cover that. I mean, for it to be exempt under the ag, the right to farm ordinance, it has to be a practice done in a way that's consistent with what an ag operation would do. So in your example, if it really is a pet and they're just trying to, you know,
well,
if it's
an fenced area in the backyard and the whatever the ag operation is somewhere over on the side or ancillary to where the dog is, I don't see it as really, you know, protecting the ag operation.
We do have a Zoom comment.
Thank you, Ms. Granboys. Please go ahead when ready.
Yes. Good morning. Hello.
Granboys, and I just wanted to hear me.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I had livestock animals for many years, and I had a dog, several dogs, to aid in watching them. And so I fully support the ability to have dogs do the protecting. But I also feel that the owner has a responsibility. When my dogs would go off at night, I would get up, I would go out, and I would check. And then if I couldn't find anything, I'd hush my dogs down and I'd go back to bed. I do think that you need to have some sort of responsibility or accountability with the owners of the dogs also. I think it's irresponsible to just let your dogs bark all night. So maybe consider some sort of ordinance to where if it's an ongoing problem night after night after night, that at least animal control could have the teeth to investigate to see if there's valid reasons for the dog barking all night long. If it's deemed okay because the dog is actually doing its job, then animal control can walk away. But I do think that it needs to, they have to have the ability to investigate on a case-by-case basis. That's my thoughts on it.
Thank you, but Cindy? You're kind of asking for a lot of interpretation by animal control, and how do you know the dog could be barking all night long because of the presence of predators?
You know, I can address that.
I understand what you're saying. I do, but I do think that there's some owner responsibility also. You've made the choice to run livestock. You've made the choice to have the dogs protect your livestock. There should be some responsibility because a dog barking can carry for, gosh, mile or more. Don't you think that there should be some balance?
Possibly. Supervisor Renato, you had a comment?
Yeah, you know, I understand what you're saying, and it's not an easy question because you're right, dogs barking can carry for a long ways, especially a big dog. A number of years back, I had like a couple of Great Pyrenees Anatolians, and they were livestock guard dogs. And there was a fair while where they were raising a lot more hell than normal and barking a lot more than normal. And I'd go out and tell them, hey, be quiet. And they'd be quiet for a while, and they'd start barking again. And wasn't too much longer after that, next-door neighbor ended up getting a bear. Probably roughly half mile from my house. Big bear, he's a pretty aggressive bear, and you know, and I noticed, I thought, man, I swore a couple of my cows had baby calves, and I thought, man, I must be wrong because I don't have them now. Look, they're kind of bagged up. I thought, boy, I think something got their calves, and I think that bear got some of my calves, and once that bear was gone, it was noticeable how much quieter the dogs got. So dogs knew the bear was there. I didn't. And I grew up in the, you know, out on a ranch. I'm used to looking for tracks. I check out anytime I see dust. Hey, what kind of tracks you got here? Snakes, coyotes, what's out there? The funny part was I never saw a bear track, and that bear was real close to my house. So you don't always know what's out there, but the dog does. Just food for thought.
This is a tough nut to crack.
Well, I think the zeroth order, you know, result that I wanted here was just to raise this to the level of the attention of the board. If it goes away, we never hear about it again, then maybe it's really not a problem. I don't know if, you know, having chickens for yourself is an ag operation. I kind of think of an ag operation as something you make money at or potentially make money at. I don't know, but I wanted to listen to my constituent. I want him to be heard, and if the dog is embedded with the livestock that they're protecting, then, you know, that might seem like I can believe that, but if they're inside at night laying on the owner's bed, like my dog, then I don't really see it as a guardian dog.
Mr. Eiley and Mr. Gillette, that's the thing. Do 9 chickens qualify as an ag operation?
The way the ordinance defines it, it probably is. I mean, the ordinance is very broad, and ag land is basically anything in the unincorporated county. I personally don't recall a time where this issue has come up. It probably has, but it hasn't risen to this level, at least.
In my time, it hasn't come up like this.
Well, this is Supervisor Brown. The one thing that we have brought up, and we have brought chickens up, that chickens are authorized in the R1A areas already. So we've already kind of touched on this as an ag operation. Previous, you know, my time on the board, we've already decided on that because I've had numerous chicken complaints.
Well, I think it's somewhat mitigated, Supervisor Axe, by the complainant looking at buying some dogs. I don't know if she's trying to fight fire from fire, but
I think so. I think that they have their own livestock. They are in a pretty remote area. You know, I just, you know, I'm here to represent my constituents. So,
okay,
and I sympathize with it because, you know, a barking animal, it can be an issue at times. But I think is a barking dog a problem? Yes, it is, absolutely. But I think if we go and address it as far as putting a dampener on ag operations, it's probably a bigger problem than the barking dog. So is there a problem there? I think, yeah, there probably is. But I think if we go and address it, are we going to create an even bigger problem? I think, yeah, we will. That's kind of my take on it.
I'm kind of seeing the consensus of the board is we'll leave this alone for now. If it becomes a bigger issue, we'll bring it back.
We're aware of it now.
Okay. Okay. With that, then, no further public comment. Then we have concluded our regular board meeting. We will take about a 10-minute break and come back to our in-home supportive services meeting.